Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Julie Smith, editor of the new anthology, New Orleans Noir, The Classics, and Lisa Alther, co-author with Francois Gillot of About Women, Conversations Between a Writer and a Painter. Julie Smith is a well-known writer of mysteries, and recently she's cast a keen critical eye on New Orleans mystery fiction in anthologies. Her first, New Orleans Noir, was published in 2007 and drew on contemporary writers for a selection of stories neatly divided into before and after Hurricane Katrina. Her newest anthology is New Orleans Noir, The Classics, and it demonstrates our city's long literary tradition of noir fiction. It is simply a knockout. So, Julie Smith, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much, Susan, and thanks for the kind words.
Oh, it's fantastic, this book. It's so much fun to read. And even though I'd read almost all of these stories, it made me look at even the ones I had read in a new light in some ways.
Noir light, you mean?
Noir light, yes. So tell us about how you chose these stories, what you were looking for, and what made you go back to the classics of noir fiction.
Well, the whole idea of the noir series is to explore a city and its neighborhoods and its diverse populations. So the first New Orleans Noir did that. And then the publisher, typically, if the first one does well, they will follow up with the classics. And that is stories that have already been written. So when I was asked to do the classics, I realized that I could literally go back as far as I wanted and that we had some incredible, amazing writers who had been through New Orleans. Just about everybody passed through New Orleans at some time or other.
And you did go way, way back.
Yeah, I think the first one is 1843.
So tell us about that one. That one was such a revelation.
That story?
Yes.
It was for me, too. I actually have to give credit where it's due. I found out about that story from Nancy Dixon, who helped me with this. And she edited the book New Orleans Lit. And that's a wonderful collection of short stories. And I found a couple of my stories in that one. This was one of them by Armand Lanous, who was part of a group of poets who were all free men of color, and they were all men, but that's quite an amazing thing. Where would you find a bunch of young men today who are poets? And they published a book called Les Sennels. That's what they call their group as well. So he wrote this story about plissage, which was the custom of rich white men taking young women of color. Then they would meet the young ladies at the Quadrine Balls, and they would become really something like a second wife. And quite a lot's been written about that custom, but I had never really thought of it from the point of view that Armand Lanous did, which was actually very sad. The women could be discarded at any point, and the story is about one who was.
You know, that's such a tribute to New Orleans literary tradition as a whole, because Les Sennels, that volume of poetry, was the first book of African-American poetry published in the United States.
It was.
Amazing,
I forgot to mention that. Yes.
But it's like, and he wrote all these other things as well, which
yes.
I think is so great. So you see this as a long, long tradition. And when you go back, when you think of noir fiction, maybe not New Orleans noir fiction, how old do you think it really is?
Noir fiction?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it goes back probably to the beginning of time.
The dark side.
Yes, seriously, the dark side's always been there. If you look at it in a broad sense, the mm-hmm. broad sense meaning just exactly what you said, the dark side. I found when I started this collection that there weren't a lot of murder mysteries, which is how we often think of noir in the early days. And really, the detective story wasn't even invented until Edgar Allan Poe came along, so it's not that surprising.
Interesting.
However, people were writing a lot about their dark sides. A lot of these stories are about suicide.
Now, tell us about some of the other writers who are included. You pull people from the very early days, like Grace King.
I did. Grace King, who was known for, I want to say racism. That term hadn't yet been invented, but she began writing to rebut the work of George Washington Cable, who was very much sympathetic to African Americans. And she'd found that objectionable for whatever reason. And yet the story that she wrote is about a young African-American girl who was unhappy with her life. How King looked at it might be different from the way we would look at it today. I'm not too sure. But a story's a story. And I thought it was a wonderful story.
And it's good to hold it up to the light and let people take a look.
And you know? There's that, too.
And then you have Kate Chopin.
Kate Chopin in what I think is a pretty amusing story about domestic, not so much bliss.
Yes. And then some of the other names will be more familiar to a lot of us. Eudora Welty, of course.
Yes, Eudora Welty, Tennessee Williams. I was thrilled to find stories by them.
And that's Desire in the Black Masseur, which is such a dark, dark
that
story.
That is one of the darkest stories I have ever read.
And Shirley Ann Grau, who's, of course, well-known to New Orleans readers. But John William Corrington, who has such a body of work and isn't as well-known as he should be.
I agree with you. I think it's a shame that some of his work has been forgotten. And the story in this book is searing.
Yes.
It is probably the darkest story in the whole book, maybe even darker than Desire in the Black Masseur. I could barely stand to read it more than once, and of course you have to, but it is quite something. Did you like that story?
Yes, I did. It just
did
blew
too.
Me away.
Yeah,
and I've read more of his work, but I keep thinking, people need to know more about him.
Yes.
They really do.
Yes. I was so pleased to find that short story. I had read his novels when they came out that he wrote with his wife, Joyce.
Joyce, a lawyer, taught at Loyola.
Yes.
I mean, just really such a writer, and wrote all those soap operas and was a screenwriter as well.
Oh, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
He did. Yes.
And then one of the stories in this book is actually a play, and that's Tom Dent's Ritual Murder.
Yes, which I thought just worked perfectly as a short story. I was really thrilled to find that. That was also in Nancy Dixon's collection. So I can't really take credit for digging it up out of nowhere, because she was the one who dug it up out of nowhere. But it was performed recently. So it's not forgotten, I'm happy to say.
And it holds up. It holds
and
up over
it
time.
It holds up amazingly. The things that happen in that play could happen today, and do, I think, on a regular basis.
And Tom Dent was such a leading light in the civil rights movement, such a fine writer with Free Southern Theater, all the things he did. He was really an amazing New Orleans writer.
He was amazing, and I'm sorry I never met him, but he died shortly after I moved back to town.
Now then, there are more contemporary writers. James Lee Burke's Jesus Out to Sea, that great post-Katrina story. Valerie Martin, O'Neill Deneau. And Nevada Barr has a very interesting
really funny story.
In this.
Yes, I read that story. The name of the story is GDMFSOB.
And you can fill in the blanks.
Yes, that pretty much says it all. Talk about a dark story. A number of these stories are about women who did not get along with their husbands.
Another one of domestic non-bliss.
Yes.
And then Ace Atkins.
Yeah, a wonderful story by Ace Atkins. Kind of has music in it and French Quarter, all kinds of true New Orleans atmosphere.
And then rising star Maurice Ruffin.
And Maurice Ruffin, yes. Maurice Ruffin is a writer that I found out about a couple of years ago. And he's written only short stories so far, and they're just wonderful. I think you really love this story. It's called Pie Man. Mm-hmm. It's about a young boy, really young, like 12 or 14, who's really gone wrong. And it really is quite moving, I thought. I think he's quite a rising star.
Yeah. And you have one of my very favorite New Orleans stories ever in this. And I hadn't really thought of it as a noir story, but of course it is. And that's Ellen Gilchrist's Rich.
Yes, to me, that's an extremely noir story.
Yes.
Actually, that was one of the first stories I thought about when I was asked to do the collection, because that's a very classic.
Yes.
New Orleans, I mean, that just cuts to the core of it to me.
And just as you did with the first anthology, you made sure that all the neighborhoods of New Orleans were represented.
Yes, all the noir books do that, though. Mm-hmm. That's one of the conditions of it. That makes it an awful lot of fun.
One neighborhood, you had to declare the setting of a story.
Yes, that was Kate Chopin's story.
Yes,
I sort of stretched that a little bit.
It worked for me.
Yes.
It totally worked for me, too. You say in your introduction that you think these stories, and I guess the thoughts behind them, inform the way we speak about violence in our city.
I think it's really interesting that a lot of the stories were written a long time ago, and they are so timely today, mm-hmm. particularly the Tom Dent play. Actually, even the Carrington story is, yes. to some extent. The domestic violence ones, has that changed? That hasn't changed at all. O'Neill Deneau's story about possible needless police brutality.
That was a really good story.
That was, I thought, one of O'Neill's best stories. I really loved that. And then there are the stories about despair. That's really violence toward oneself. But I think the Ellen Gilchrist story is a really great example of that, of a person who is kind of mired in a culture that he doesn't really understand and has all kinds of issues with that he can't talk to anyone about.
Yeah. What has this done for you as a writer, reading all this fiction and looking at it with this keen, critical sense you have? I mean, because you have this wonderful ability to make a complete picture of our city in these books, which you do.
Well, thank you, Susan. I don't understand these writers who say that they don't read, and also that they don't read in their genre. I think I learn from every single writer I do read. And so many writers, you know, all of these stories, really, I read and I think, I wish that I had that artistry. I wish that I could have done that. Mm-hmm. And I hope that I learned something from all of them.
Well, editing an anthology is a terrific act of generosity. You know, it's like you're looking at this great field of material and going, I'll take you and you and you.
It's so much fun.
You can tell.
It is really so much fun. I just love doing that. I loved finding this incredible array of delights out there. And there were stories, you know, that I couldn't use. There were stories that I might have liked to use that I couldn't use. But I did get 18 in. I think I was supposed to have 14, and I managed to talk them into 18.
Way to go. Readers are grateful. So, we've been talking with Julie Smith, who's the editor of the new anthology, New Orleans Noir, The Classics. You can meet her Tuesday, March 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. She'll be appearing along with Ace Atkins, Nevada Barr, O'Neill Deneau, and Maurice Ruffin. Julie, thank you so much.
Susan, a pleasure to be here.
I'm very excited to talk with my next guest about her new book, About Women, Conversations Between a Writer and a Painter. Liza Author is a distinguished novelist and memoirist, author of Kinflicts, a feminist classic published in 1975. Since then, she's written many novels, a memoir, and a history of the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys. Her writing partner, Francoise Gillot, is a world-renowned painter and author of the memoir Life with Picasso. They've been friends for more than 25 years, and About Women is a record of their long, ongoing conversation. Liza Author, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Oh, this book is so delicious. When you read it, it makes the reader want to be friends with both of you immediately.
Thank you.
So how did you go about making the book? Were these conversations taking place face-to-face? Did you record them, edit them? How did that work?
Well, Francoise and I became friends in 1986 when I had a book coming out in Paris, Other Women, my third novel, and she was having a art show, and we were at the same gallery bookstore for the openings, and that was when we met, and we hit it off and stayed friends. So in 1995, I believe, I was living in Paris for a while because my editor there was encouraging me to write a novel set in France. So I was over there trying to decode the mysteries of the French, and there was a lot that I didn't understand about French women. And so Francoise at the time had a studio on Montmartre, still does. So I would go up there and describe to her some of the experiences I had had, and she would explain to me about French attitudes towards fashion and feminism and women, and it was so interesting to me that I started taping them. So we both enjoyed these conversations a lot, so we kept having them over a period of 3 years. And so I transcribed the tapes, and then I just put the manuscript away. I had to go home to Tennessee and help take care of my elderly parents, so the manuscript just sat moldering in my drawer in New York, and we forgot all about it. And then a couple of years ago, after my parents died, I started spending time in New York again, and I discovered that manuscript and read it and thought that it was more interesting than I had remembered. And I showed it to Françoise, and she was surprised also. So we decided to work on it some more and turn it into a book.
Now, one of the things that struck me so forcefully is how much your lives, both of your lives, were shaped by war, up close and personally, and starting in childhood.
Yes, that's true. Certainly her life more drastically than mine, but mine also.
And that's an amazing thing to me, you know. It makes me wonder how many people actually acknowledge that, or whether it's something you kind of tamp down and try to learn to live with.
Yes, Françoise was impacted by World War One and World War Two. She was born right after World War One, and her uncle was killed in the war, and her other uncle fought in the war, and her father did. And so that sort of shaded her whole early childhood, and then when she was a teenager, or late teens, World War II started, and she was living in Paris during the occupation and was taken as a hostage by the Germans at one point. And so she was rather traumatically impacted by both those wars.
And for you, it was a little different.
Yes, my father was sent to boot camp about 10 days after I was born, and then he was shipped out to Cheyenne, Wyoming. So my mother put me in an orange crate. That was my car seat, the orange crate in the back floor of the car, and took my brother John, whom you know, who was 2 years old at the time. And we drove 35 miles an hour to save gas and to save tires, and ended up in Cheyenne. And as soon as we got there, he was shipped to Abilene, Texas. So we got back in the car and drove to Texas. And as soon as we got there, he was sent on a secret mission on a train with the window shades pulled down, and we didn't know where he was going. He ended up in England and then in France. He was a doctor, so he was in field hospitals and medical units.
I was also struck by how peripatetic you both were. You moved around a lot when you were young, you know.
Well, my brother and I are still like that. I just wonder how much it influenced us, all that early motion.
Oh, right. Well, we should say at this point that your brother is the well-known Southern writer, John Sheldon Reed. But like most women, you know, one of the things that I found charming was the way you talk about the women who were your role models.
Well, I've been fortunate to have several very powerful women as ancestors. My mother's grandmother was one of the suffragists. She was related to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, a distant cousin. And she lived in upstate New York and gave speeches to the Grange and the WCTU and that sort of thing. And finally, she told her husband, if I don't get out of this town, I'm going to go crazy. So she insisted that he take her to Washington, D.C., because that was where all the suffragist action was at the time. So they lived in a hotel because she hated housework. And he worked at the U.S. Mint, and she marched in all those marches, and she met Susan B. Anthony and the heavyweights in the women's movement at the time. I have read her letters. They were all about what kind of hats and dresses the women were wearing at their conventions, so she may have been kind of superficial.
However, I'm going to say this. She talked about what people wore, and you and Françoise also talk about fashion and what people wear. I mean,
yes.
There's a whole segment about the little black dress.
Yes, yes, we did talk a lot about that, and partly because fashion is so important in France, as you know. I mean, it's important psychically, but it's also an important part of their economy, and it's very important to Françoise herself. She's always so beautifully dressed, and me less so. So it was a point of contrast. We were studying the similarities and differences between French and American culture, and specifically Southern American culture. And that was one point of contrast for me.
Well, so many of your conversations follow these cultural lines. I love that Francois said that in France, people work all day so they can have a nice evening.
Yes.
And here, people work all day so they can become rich or be efficient. So yeah. Did she make you more French in this friendship, you think?
In a certain sense, I think she did, because, you know, we would talk and we would sometimes clash. And then I would go home and I would think about what she had said, and it would start to make sense to me. And it certainly opened my mind up, I think. You know, part of the process was sort of seeing how much of our beliefs and behavior had been shaped by the conditioning of our cultures. And it had a very powerful effect on me in terms of, I think, opening me up to the points of view of people seemingly different from myself.
When you met each other, did you know immediately that you would be friends, that this was a person you could say anything to?
Well, my first memory of her was that we were at this joint opening for her art show and my book launch, and it was being staged by a group called MLF, and a group of them had chartered a plane to go to the Arctic Circle to see the summer solstice sun. So they were determined that I was going to go with them, and I thought that I had to because they were my hosts, but I just wanted to go back home to Vermont and plant my radishes. So Françoise was listening to this conversation, and she drew me aside, and she said, "Look, you don't have to go to the Arctic Circle if you don't want to." So that gave me the courage to turn down the invitation, and that was when I first realized that we might develop a friendship, because she had such a good sense of humor and was so matter-of-fact and down-to-earth. But I didn't see her again for 3 years, so it was slow in developing.
You found that your artistic interests fed each other. I love that. I love that your creative lives came together very nicely.
Yes, we were surprised. We discovered that we really did have quite a kinship in terms of her painting and my writing, in that we both saw our artwork as sort of a search for truth about our own lives, and also as very much a process of discovery, in the sense that, you know, neither of us knew what we were in search of when we would start a painting, in her case, or a novel or a story in my case. And it was as the work developed that we learned things about ourselves. So she also, as a painter, often tells herself stories. And I, as a writer, tend to write in terms of visual imagery. So we discovered that there were a lot of parallels.
And what does it mean to you to have this conversation in book form? Because conversation is, you know, such a pleasure in life, and it's often so ephemeral. We often wish we could call it back. And this book in particular is such a beautiful little book, with Francois' art throughout and, you know, family photographs, and all that comes to life in this book. What does that mean to you to look at the book itself?
Well, you know, when we first started doing it, we didn't have any intention of doing a book. It was just sheer pleasure of good conversation. And then at some point we decided that we needed a sort of a structure, so we thought up all the titles for the chapters, and then we used that as a way to sort of focus our discussions. But still, I mean, it was a creative project, but we didn't think of it as a book, and it wasn't until we went back to it a couple of years ago that we realized that there was a flow to it that we hadn't been aware of, and that there were also themes that ran through it that we also hadn't been aware of, the main one being black and white, light and darkness. There's a chapter called Ceremonies in White and another called The Little Black Dress, and then at the end there's a chapter called The Middle Path, about the need to walk the fine line between the light and the dark. We were just quite astonished to see that it could be a book. But in terms of having it in print now, I think for both of us, it's extremely surprising and very satisfying.
Ah, that's good. Yeah. Well, it's a really lovely book, and there's some great stories of weddings in this book, which we will tantalize the reader with. Oh, I've been lucky enough to talk with Liza Alther. With Françoise Gillot, she is the co-author of The Inspiring and Delightful About Women, Conversations Between a Writer and a Painter. You can meet them both when they come to New Orleans for events at the Mann Gallery, 305 Royal Street. An exhibition of Françoise's drawings will open Saturday, February 27th from 6 to 9, and the two of them will sign About Women Sunday, February 28th from 1 to 3. Liza, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Marissa Marchetto reads from and signs her novel, Antenna, Tuesday, February 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Poet Laura Mullen signs Complicated Grief, Wednesday, February 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Local women artists of color from BrassyBrown.com and Wild Seeds, the New Orleans Octavia Butler Emergent Strategy Collective, present Kindred, a celebration of Black women in the arts with readings and multimedia art Wednesday, February 24th from 6 to 7:30 at the Rosa Keller Library. Taylor Brown discusses his first novel, Fallen Land, with novelist Kent Wascom Thursday, February 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Vincent Kerr discusses his book Louisiana Aviation, An Extraordinary History in Photographs, Thursday, February 25th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Room 220 presents a reading from Souffles Anfus, a critical anthology from the Moroccan Journal of Culture and Politics, Thursday, February 25th at 7 at the Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude. The Dogfish Reading Series presents Anya Groner and Maurice Ruffin, Thursday, February 25th at 7 at 2448 North Villery Street. The Jane Austen Society of North America, Louisiana Region, holds its February meeting Saturday, February 27th from 2 to 4 at the Keller Library with guest speaker Molly Rothenberg of Tulane University discussing the importance of being Miss Bates. Please RSVP to Bev Hegre, that's BevHegre, at gmail.com. Alberta Dunn reads from and signs her new children's book, Little Red Meets the Three Little Pigs, Saturday, February 27th at 3 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Today's guests, Liza Alther and Françoise Gillot, co-authors of About Women, Conversations Between a Writer and a Painter, appear at the Mann Gallery, 305 Royal Street this weekend. An exhibition of Françoise's drawings will open Saturday, February 27th from 6 to 9, and the two of them will sign About Women Sunday, February 28th from 1 to 3. Carol Boston Weatherford signs Freedom in Congo Square, Sunday, February 28th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Mary Arno signs Thanksgiving, Monday, February 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Emily Barr signs Urban Revolutions, A Woman's Guide to Two-Wheel Transportation, Tuesday, March 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Julie Smith, signs New Orleans Noir, The Classics, along with Ace Atkins, Nevada Barr, O'Neill Deneau, and Maurice Ruffin, Tuesday, March 1st from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Zadie Smith appears as part of her residency as a Zale Kimmerling writer at Newcomb College Institute, presenting a reading Tuesday, March 1st at 7 at the Levin Burnick Center Kendall Cram Room at Tulane University. And watch for Friends of the New Orleans Public Library book sales all over town. The Algiers Regional Sale is open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday from 10 to 2. There's another at Smith in Lakeview, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday from 1 to 5. And the Friends sell books at the Palmer Arts Market, the last Saturday of every month from 10 to 4. And watch for a pop-up sale coming soon to Norman Mayer. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.